Yep, 8 feet under. Thank God it's vertical and not horizontal, if you know what I mean. My aunt concluded some time ago that the energy sapper really didn't actually know that he or she was doing this to other people. That was the thrust of her conclusion. We'll be back in a moment with Jonathan Zapp on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Jonathan Zapp, our guest. Jonathan, let's talk a little bit more about these sappers and parasites. And what did Carl Jung once say about them in terms of shadow projection? Explain that.
Well, what Jung said, and by the way, George, I just realized when you were announcing things that you're in the cave tonight, which I didn't realize was coming up, and that's kind of interesting and maybe synchronistic, or as you would say, there are no coincidences, because one theory about mind parasites has to do with caves and with dense stone walls, strangely enough.
Really?
I have a friend named Marcus who came up with a theory that the reason why so many hermits and spiritual adepts would go into caves, and he believed the reason why the pyramids were created with such dense walls, is that you are insulated from a certain type of psychic attack. That even though these are energetic organisms and they can pass through solid materials, that it's quite uncomfortable for them to do so. And that for this reason, ghosts will tend to, according to some lore, always pass through the same part of the wall. It's as if they've left a part of their energetic body there, and it makes it a little bit easier, but they don't like to pass through solid substances. And if it's that thick, it may be still more uncomfortable.
That's so interesting.
Consider yourself protected right now.
Yeah, it is thick. I tell you what, the only thing that seems to leak through here, Jonathan, are crickets and millipedes. I have a feeling they were here long before the cave was, to tell you the truth.
Right.
But shadow, when Jung talked about shadow projection, is that the same as what we've always talked about on this program before, shadow people?
Well, no, not exactly. Although the shadow people could be visual artifacts of parasites, particularly if they are the preta, the sort that the Buddhists call pretas, the hungry ghosts, would sound a lot like some of the reports about shadow people and some of the nighttime attacks that people would frequently describe to me when
right.
they come for dream interpretation that I'd notice would be totally devoid of psychological content. They'd be very stereotyped. They'd be very similar, like, you know, with the old hag syndrome and with the night terrors. You would hear the same shadowy figure. There would be no, like, it didn't say it looked like my dad, or there would be no, like, psychological individual content to these experiences. But what Jung meant by shadow projection was something that could also be influenced by parasites, but was a tendency that creates so many of the evils that we experience on the planet, and especially what's going on with the Middle East. It was that people would be unwilling to recognize and accept their own shadow, their own personal darkness, and so they would tend to project it out onto others. And a classic example would be the Nazis, who would claim that the Jews were trying to rule the world. Meanwhile, they wanted to have a 1,000-year Reich. Well, fanatical Islamists say about the same thing, and yet they want to have a worldwide jihad, and they feel that they haven't fulfilled their mission until the entire planet is their particular Muslim sect. And, you know, not just even Muslim. It's got to be Sunni, or it's got to be Shiite, or whatever. And in fact, there's even a connection between the Nazis and the Muslims and even Hezbollah. There's a couple of images that Lex linked up on your site where people can see a Muslim Nazi flag from World War II, where the people don't realize that the Nazis actually had some of these fanatical Islamists working with them. There is also an image of some of them bowing in their traditional prayers while amongst a Nazi corps. Other images on the same website, those came from show Hezbollah guerrillas in their initiation ceremony, and they have the Nazi salute. And so there is a certain strange spirit that Jung recognized about the Nazis and their intense shadow projection onto the Jews. They seem to be possessed. You can try and explain these things, and many people will criticize what I'm saying and say, well, you know, it was our bad foreign policies that created this, and so forth. You could say the same thing about the Nazis. You could say that the Treaty of Versailles that humiliated Germany created Hitler and the Nazis, but it's just really nonsense. It created more fertile conditions. But there was this type of fanaticism before there was a U.S. government, before there was an Israel, before there were globalizing corporations. And its extremity and intensity cannot be explained very easily. Now, Jung was very interested and considered himself a Gnostic. He was very interested in the Gnostics. And it was only after World War II, after this tremendous evil happened, that the Nag Hammadi Library was discovered out in the desert, which contained almost everything we know about Gnosticism. And the Gnostics believed there were archons. They warned us about the time that we are facing right now. They warned us even before there was an Islam. They said that the archons, that were parasitic deities that map onto very well what Alex described, would manipulate us through religious ideologies. This is exactly what they said. In fact, there's even a Gnostic text that I put up on the website and the thing about Alex that shows parallels between his painting and an ancient Gnostic text.
They didn't know when it would happen. They just knew it would.
Well, they knew it was both a prophecy and it was an actuality while they were alive. This has been going on for a couple of thousand years.
Right, it's been ongoing.
The Gnostics were killed off,
sure,
by other religious fanatics. So this is not new, but now the stakes are just getting ratcheted up there even higher. And it's one of the most efficient ways that we can be controlled to keep up the harvest of negative energies, because parasites have a certain inferiority in that they cannot directly access the source of nourishment the way we do. They need to step down our energy. They can only feed off of, apparently, the baser human energies. They can't feed off of love and tranquility and consciousness and this type of thing. They can feed off of fear and anger and desire and rage and passion and this type of thing. One of the most efficient ways to keep us in a kind of state of
chaos, I guess. Right,
exactly. That makes us, you know, a delicious feast for them. It is through a fanatical ideology, especially a religious one, that completely controls a person's outlook. Now, one very hopeful sign in this is one of the greatest coast shows ever heard. I think it was Wednesday when you had on, was his name Waleed?
Well, Waleed Shuibat.
Right.
That's right. Wednesday night. Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
Thursday night. Thursday night.
Thursday night. That was, and anybody that doesn't have Streamlink needs to get it, if only to hear that one show, because that was one of the most important interviews I've ever heard, and it was all about mind parasite infection and recovery. And it's hopeful, because here is this person who describes how from the earliest age he was being inculcated and totally accepted an ideology of fanatical and delusory hate. And then his confrontation with it and discovering that it was a bunch of lies and his pulling himself out of it and reversing it. Well, that is a tremendously hopeful occasion. You know, even if this is one person, William James once said, all that's necessary to disprove the notion that all crows are black is one white crow. Well, this gentleman is a white crow, and what one man can do, another can do, or a woman. And so the fact that he was able to get out of that shows that the human spirit can transcend this type of infestation, which, according to the Gnostics, would particularly take the form of extreme ideologies.
You know, when I was putting this program together, Jonathan, and I was talking about what has occurred on this planet lately, and I did a lot of thinking when I was on this airplane, because I wanted to see what things were like at airports. And let me tell you, it's a hassle to travel. You got to. But, I mean, things are just so crazy right now. I mean, it's just a hassle. But I'm at a point now where I don't even like to use the word terrorist anymore. I think what this is a battle between good and evil. And I think there's a lot of evil out there. And I really believe that even in a peaceful existence, evil will still crop up. My question to you is does evil and good balance out, or will evil win one day, or will good win one day? I mean, can evil be that powerful that it would win?
Well, I'm a huge optimist. If you may remember from our previous show, I see us heading toward a transcendent evolutionary event that actually takes an intensification of darkness to create the change to bring that about. And I think we're in a time of heightened, what Terence McKenna called novelty, of change and transformation. And what you would expect to happen in such a time is that the outer edge of light and the outer edge of dark will both intensify. But because there's free will, I believe, even though there's probably less of it than we would like to think, you know, things tremble in the balance. In the ancient Jewish book, the Talmud, it's written that before God created the earth, he created many other planets as experiments, and that these experiments failed and were destroyed. And one rabbi suggested to me, maybe the earth, too, will be destroyed. But we still, our efforts to transcend that battle of opposites are still worthwhile. And I think we are seeing it intensifying as we are getting toward an evolutionary event horizon. And you know, the face of evil changes. It could be a serial killer one day. It could be the Nazis. It could be, well, the Christian fundamentalists in the Middle Ages were the ones that were the inquisitors and that burned millions of women as witches.
It could be a politician who gets elected.
Absolutely. It could be in our own government. It could be the Illuminati. It could be all kinds of things. And that's something that people have trouble with. The whole idea of political correctness is it's basically a template of what projections are allowed and what aren't. Political correctness says you can project the dark force into the U.S. government and onto Israel and to corporations, but not onto exotic cultures. But one of the strange things about the fanatical Islamists, the Muslims, that is even stranger than the Nazis is their violence toward their own women. This is unreported, but I do some work with a nonprofit called womensassistance.com, and there are 100,000 Muslim women each year that are killed in honor killings and stove burnings for walking too proud, for laughing out loud in public. People can read a document on the front page of my site called Jihad Against the Feminine by my friend Sean Moffitt, who has done tremendous work to raise money right now, raising money for a safe house in Pakistan run by a Muslim woman, Shaniz Bakari, who's taken in 6,000 burned women in the last 6.5 years.
6,000 from one town. Burned women. Oh, my
right,
God.
Right, right. Most of them don't live. And so this is what they are doing to their own people. And it's strange when you can overcome the will toward self-preservation and attack your own kind to such a degree. They're in the July 31st Time magazine, they mention in passing a mural in Iran that shows a woman with a suicide vest on. And the caption of the mural says, motherhood is great, but martyrdom is greater.
God.
And, you know, this death force, Jung, Freud called it thanatos, we find it not just in the Islamists. Let's not make it all about them, because that just leads toward shadow projection. For example, in Stalin's Russia, the KGB, here they killed millions of their own fellow Russian citizens who were completely innocent, even of sins that only a communist would recognize as a sin. And instead of just hauling them off and taking them off to the gulag or shooting them in the streets, they would go to elaborate efforts. They would, for example, have a KGB agent come up to you in a bar and for hours buy you drinks and pretend to be your friend and then denounce you to make it more terrifying. There was no reason for this. It served no purpose, just like it serves no purpose for them to destroy their own women.
That's pure evil.
And yet they do it out of, exactly, in a way that we cannot explain through ordinary human psychology. And that's why I think we have to be willing to look at an unknown factor like parasites and things above us in the food chain that could be manipulating us.
Well, all things considered, though, Jonathan, will evil win or will good win? Blow by blow, who wins? What wins?
Well, I think it's like a great drama, George. It's more exciting not to know. And I think we do our best efforts when we feel it hangs in the balance. Like Galadriel said to the Ring Fellowship, your quest rests upon the edge of a knife. Stray but a little, and you will fall to the ruin of all.
See, I've always believed that eventually good will win. I mean, we're going to have some battles we're going to lose, but eventually the war of good versus evil will be won by good. I mean, that's the way I think. That's the way I believe. I hope I'm right.
Well, I think my bet is with you, George, and if you remember from our previous show, we talked about the singularity archetype. The evidence in this archetype that sort of bubbles up from the collective unconscious is that what seems like the darkest of the dark is revealed from a higher vantage to be a transcendent evolutionary event. So I think that we need tremendous pressure. It's like the dark night of the soul or the initiation rite that takes you to the edge of death. I think the species is setting that up for itself. I think it needs to intensify the darkness and the suffering to create change. And so I'm with you. I think that something very transcendent can come out of all this, but it's going to be a very rough ride getting there.
I was talking months ago about a guy here in St. Louis who was, he would walk into a lounge, and he was a nice guy. I mean, just, he was a nice guy, but for some reason, Jonathan, he exhausted you just by being next to you. He was an energy sapper. And as my aunt would say, this guy had no idea he was doing it. He wasn't doing it to hurt people. He wasn't being intentional. But he was wiping out the place. He was clearing it out. It got to a point where in a lounge of 100 people, the only two left were the bartender and this guy. And the bartender was on the other side of the bar. I mean, in the far corner, away from him. He couldn't handle it anymore. About a month or so ago, we ran into this guy again. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I don't know what he did, but his whole persona had changed. He actually had a few people around him laughing and enjoying his company. But he also looked different. He changed his appearance. I don't know what he did, but somewhere along the line, somebody must have, maybe he was listening to this program, because I've talked about him a couple times. Maybe it dawned on him that he was doing this, and maybe he just wasn't aware of it.
Well, exactly, and those people can change, often without realizing they're changed. Here's what your aunt, Dr. Shafika Karigula, wrote on Breakthrough to Creativity. There are certain people who do not seem to be able to pick up their own energy from the surrounding ocean of energy which the sensitives describe. They appear to take their energy pre-digested from the people in their immediate vicinity. So this makes them like the parasites, in that they need their energy stepped down instead of accessing different cultures called chi or prana or life energy. They need to draw it from other people. They don't have a centered enough personality where they can draw it themselves. And she also writes, such individuals may be totally unaware of their energy pull in other people. They may simply feel better when they're in company of more vital people. Any individual who remains in the vicinity of the sapper for too long begins to feel desperately exhausted for no reason that they can understand. And they feel baffled and bewildered, and they try and escape but feel guilty and so forth. Now, something that I've wondered is, you know, it could just be that this is a pattern in nature.
Could
but it's
be.
Also a pattern sort of entrained by nature, by the fact that we're maybe surrounded by other parasites doing exactly the same kind of transaction. It's also possible that, and this is pure speculation, but I did have one personal dramatic experience with such
a sapper.
Well, this was beyond a sapper. This was a true vampire, somebody who actually told me they were a vampire and seemed to have a kind of symbiont-like relationship with some other entity that lived within him that was capable of working through him to draw energy in a much more massive way.
So he might have been possessed.
There's a very fine line. I think possession may be, you know, I think I'm giving a secular point of view, but to a religious person would say, well, you're talking about demonology and you're talking about possession. And I would say, you're right. These are maybe just different flavors or ways of describing the same thing. And if you want, I could tell you the story about this person, or we could just talk about it.
Yeah, let's get that story when we come back. And also, as you know, Jonathan, I am not a fan of clowns. I love the Shriners. I think they do a great job for people and children. But I just don't like clowns. And you have something to say about clowns and parasites. So I want to get this tie-in and find out what the heck's going on. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, you're welcome. I didn't have an opportunity to thank you for sending me those thank you emails when we opened up the free StreamLink weekend a week or so ago. We'll do that a couple times a year for you, those of you who are not StreamLink members, so you can participate and enjoy and get a little taste of the flavor of what StreamLink is all about and the podcasting and everything else. A lot of you signed up for it just with that free weekend. But we will do that again, and just figure every 6 months or so we'll do another free StreamLink weekend just for you.
ZapOracle.com is Jonathan's website, which is linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. You can take a look at the many things that he has done in his career as we approach his work with the mind. And I really like what he's done, too, with prophecy. All right, Jonathan, tell us a little bit about this vampire, if you would.
Okay, well, this is a very complex story, and I'm going to have to give you a shortened version of it. If people All want right. the full version, it's in my essay, Mind Parasites, Energy Parasites, Vampires, on the website for free, or they can get the CD audio set I've just been just produced called the Mind Parasite Matrix, where there's an even fuller description of this episode. But cutting out some of the history, I knew a very young couple in my travels. They were both very charismatic and very good looking. And I didn't see him for about a year, and then I came across the young woman, who's well, I'll call Sapphire, a pseudonym.
Sapphire?
Sapphire, just what I came up with in the essay for whatever reasons. But it was very exotically beautiful, sort of racially unidentifiable. And after I hadn't seen her for a year, there was an amazing transformation. She had become a much more open person. She seemed like a borderline personality type who, was just pathologically shy, the year before. And so we had a couple of very good talks. And then a couple of weeks later, I hadn't seen the male part of this duo, whose name was Nicholas, yet. But a couple of weeks later, I get a phone call, and it's from Nicholas, and Sapphire is about to go off to another country with another guy after they had been together for 3.5 years.
Okay. And breaks his heart, no doubt, right?
Right. So he's totally heartbroken. He asked if he could come over and talk to me and get an I Ching reading, something I do for people. And of course, I said yes. At the time, I was traveling, and I was in a small RV. But I said, yeah, come over, and I'll make some tea, and we'll talk about it. And so we did a couple of I Ching readings. We talked about it. And then suddenly he said, like, okay, I'm talked out about this. I've been talking to everybody I know about this all day. I'd like to change the subject. And I'm like, okay, go ahead. And he says, I think I'm a vampire. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, I feed off of other people's energy. I said, well, can you give me an example? And he said, well, you. Ever since I've known you, I've fed off of your energy, and there's even been a sexual undercurrent to it, which seemed to come totally out of left field.
Yeah, I would guess so, yeah.
Right. I had no inkling of that whatsoever, and I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? Everybody feeds off of each other energy to some extent, and I was basically making a classic mistake, which I've done before, which is I was being overly sympathetic and not really taking what he was saying seriously enough. I thought, like, oh, he's traumatized, this is low self-esteem, blah, blah, blah. I was just falling into pop psychology in my own mind and not heeding a very specific warning. And anyway, we talked some more about a variety of different things. He told me a lot of history of his life I didn't know before about how he had been very promiscuous. He had been abandoned by his parents. He had a very strange history that you wouldn't have guessed to look at him, because he was always perfectly groomed and seemed very polished, but he had actually come from a very violent background and had been very violent himself as well, as he confessed with some shame. Anyway, this talk went well into the night, and suddenly he realized that the buses that would take him back to the town where he lived had stopped, and he had no place to go, and it was an extremely cold and windy night, and he asked if he could stay on my RV. And of course, I had to say yes, and I had a sleeping loft that could easily have slept three people. So I said, look, go take the far end of the loft, and I'll take the near side when I get up there, because I wanted him to go to sleep first, because I'm a dreamer, and I have dream recall. The price I pay for that is being a super light sleeper, so unless everybody else is asleep, I can't go to sleep.
Well, plus he also said he was interested in you, so you definitely wanted him to go to sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
First, right?
Right. So anyway, he seemed to fall asleep immediately, and I collected my thoughts and so forth, and then I got up in the sleeping loft, and I took the far near side to give as much personal space as possible. Well, I was lying there for a couple of minutes, and then he seemed to roll over while he was asleep so that three parts of his body were just slightly touching mine, his toes, his knees, and his forehead. And I'm like, well, it's a little uncomfortable, but I don't want to wake this guy up. He's had such a traumatic day, and so forth. And so eventually I fall asleep. Well, sometime in the middle of the night, some kind of internal warning system woke me wide awake in just a splintered moment. And what I experienced was one of the most shocking and anomalous things I've ever experienced. What I experienced was this massive energy transfer coming out of me and into him. Something was siphoning out so much energy from me that I felt if this continued for even a few more heartbeats, I wouldn't be able to resist it. I don't even know if I would be me anymore. And I, at the same time, and these are going to sound like a sequence of perceptions, but it was sort of like one of those moments where, you know, there's a multi-layered simultaneity of like many different perceptions. I was aware of another entity up on the loft with us. It seemed to be a dark rotating cloud, lenticular in shape, like a spiral galaxy, like a double convex lens shape, and it was rotating. And I sensed that it was supervising this energy transfer in some way. And as I became more aware, and my will to resist seemed to emerge like, you know, a sword pulled out of a sheath, because I'm suddenly aware that, you know, something is trying to, like, take all my energy away, and I'm gathering my will, and at the same time, my mind is coming alive, because I'm like, I've been studying mind parasites, and like, wow, now I'm seeing something, you know, really happening, and that took me out of the fear aspect. And so my energy was no longer burning at a temperature, I believe at least, of course this is all speculative, that this organism could feed off of. And then it made a kind of very weird sound, a sound that I can't possibly reproduce or describe, but the meaning of it was completely clear at the moment. It was the sound of a hungry animal interrupted in its feeding. It was a sound of like deep frustration. And at that moment, the entity vanished, the energy transfer stopped, and it was just the two of us lying on the sleeping loft. Well, I laid awake for a while. There was no longer any feeling of a threat. I just stayed awake to make sure nothing else was going to happen and to just indelibly imprint this experience into my memory. The next morning, when he woke up, I told Nicholas about what had happened, and he didn't seem the least bit surprised. And he reminded me that he had told me the day before that he was a vampire. I certainly can't say he pulled the wool over my eyes. And we parted on good terms, and I've never seen him since.
Could that be a reason why he broke up with this girl, because she couldn't, you know, stand it anymore?
Well, he thought so. That was one of the things that he said, that train of the conversation led to, is he wondered if maybe that was why she wasn't staying with him. But on the other hand, and she also confirmed this, because this is one of the strange twists of this case, he had a tremendously positive effect on her. And he was in many ways a very talented and charismatic person. So I see him as a victim. He, according to his own testimony, he may have been abused as a child by his own father when between ages 1 through 4, which he has no memory. It seemed plausible in his case. There was no, like, incest survivor self-pity in him. It just seemed like he may have been right about that. And it led to very self-destructive, promiscuous behavior. And he may have been infected with something and not been fully in control of what was going on.
Are there some people, Jonathan, who need to be near these psychic vampires, these energy sappers? I mean, we talk about the energy sapper, the psychic vampire, sometimes being aware, sometimes not, of what he or she does. But what about the victims? Do they need to get fed off of?
Well, I mean, I think that's a good point, George. There's a Annie Lennox of the Eurythmics. There's a line from one of her classic songs. Some people want to abuse you. Some people want to be abused. You know, there are the sadists and there are the masochists. There was the German cannibal that was in the courts a couple years ago when they were trying to decide if this was voluntary manslaughter or what exactly it was, because he had advertised that he wanted to eat somebody and had found a very willing volunteer, and they proceeded to satisfy each other's desires. So there are some people that do want to be devoured, but you have to wonder here, we talked about possession, are they being controlled by parasites? Because we know, if you read the book Parasite Rex, we know that even microbial parasites have an ability to take over the will of a host organism that's much more complex than they are. For example, rabies.
Well, but how many times have we seen couples, maybe the guy with the girl or the girl with the guy, where one of them treats the other one rotten, yet the other one seems to keep coming back for more, seems to be, you know, I don't want to say they enjoy it, but they tend to be more with the person who treats them rotten than the good person, the good guy or the good girl. Why is that?
Well, this is a very classic pattern. And, of course, there's a certain caution we have to say here, which is that we don't want to fall into the fallacy of attributing everything to the parasites, because we don't want to rule out ordinary neurotic psychology. The two kind of blur into each other. And, we can fall into a dangerous thing of, like, you know, the devil made me do it, where, you know, we can attribute everything to parasites. We don't really know where they leave off and regular human craziness begins. And we definitely don't want to disempower people into thinking that there's outside forces controlling them, because your psyche is your sovereign realm, and there are a lot of people in these abusive relationships, and they need to take responsibility for it and take themselves out of the abusive relationship. But you really have to wonder how this works. Sometimes the parasite is spread by what they call a meme, M-E-M-E. It's a unit of cultural transmission. And this can create these very destructive relationships. And sometimes I can give you an example of how one person saying one sentence can create a parasitic infestation in somebody that may govern their relationships for the rest of their life. Let's say, for example, we have a very sensitive high school student. Let's make him a male in this case. And he really cares about a particular girlfriend. And they have a soulful relationship. But maybe she succumbs to some temptation. Of course, it could be the reverse. It could be female to male. I'm not saying that females are more likely to succumb to temptations than males. Far from it. But she, in typical high school fashion or adult fashion, cheats on him. And he's devastated. And so now he's feeling this tremendous heartbroken feeling. And often adults, you know, disparage what adolescents feel. But for them, it's, you know, as intense as anything. And he goes up to his best friend seeking help. And his best friend, so influential in this moment, and he's so vulnerable, says to him, well, that's just the way they are. So just blank them and forget them. Now, in that one sentence, if it's accepted, and this is a meme, it's a unit of cultural transmission, that could then govern his eros and the conduct of his relationships for the rest of his life. And in that conduct, he will spread that contagion, that soul-destroying contagion, to many others. So there are many ways in which parasites can occur. That's why they say there are many species. It could be an idea, a thought form, that then it comes to dominate somebody. So many people in these abusive relationships picked up poisonous ideas, poisonous patterns from the way people have treated them in the past, and then they go ahead and keep reproducing that.
It's almost as if they need to feed on it or get fed off it. I've seen it time and time again, Jonathan, and it just boggles my mind. I just don't understand it.
Well, these are very mind-boggling things, and you know, they cost people their lives. They cost people their souls, and they also happen in the world. Everything we see, it's kind of like, you know, a fractal, the small part recapitulates the whole. That abusive relationship that we see between people is recapitulated by the nation states, where, you know, these cycles of oppression and violence just keep on going for centuries. And sometimes it's hard to tell what's really behind all of that.
Okay, what's wrong with my clown phobia? What's happening to me?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. It's something that seems to be fairly universal, and I think it has to do also with kind of weird caricatured representations of the human form. Puppets sometimes too turn up in horror movies, and clowns as well. For example, Stephen King's classic novel It.
Yes.
Which was made, I didn't read the book, but the movie was brilliant.
With the pointy teeth.
Right, and there's some kind of gigantic parasitic organism that lives under this town. But when it emerges and personifies itself to bring terror and abduction and horror into the lives of the people of the town, it appears as Pennywise the Clown. I had a mind parasite experience in Mexico 2 years ago. I was traveling to some of the ancient Mayan sites with my friend John Major Jenkins. I know you've had him on the show.
Oh, sure. Great guy.
Absolutely. And we were heading toward, we were in Chichen Itza, and I started to feel this pulsation of energy. And this was in broad daylight. And I started to see these horrific images, and they'd be lit stroboscopically, like by, as if by lightning. And the first image that I saw was in, you're not going to like this, George, but was an army of clowns with empty eye sockets.
Oh, God.
And they had...
Trying to give me nightmares now?
Well, I hope not, but their skin was covered with a white powder, like talcum powder, and they had floppy, organic-looking ears, like elephant ears, and underneath the white powder were cancerous, metastasizing lesions. But then when I summoned my will to, like, destroy this image, then they took the form of, like, stinging insects. And what I realized was, you know, like, the devil has the power to assume a pleasing form. It also has the power to assume unpleasing forms, specifically to terrorize you. So I think what's frightening about clowns is that they're kind of simulacrum. They're kind of like a semi-organic but semi-inorganic representation of the human form that has a resemblance to these, some of these phantoms that haunt our mind and haunt our unconscious, that may be representations of the archons or the parasites, where they appear in these grotesque caricatures to frighten us. And I just want to, and you know, John Wayne Casey, the serial killer.
Yep, he dressed up like a clown. He sure did.
But I think we should also add in fairness that, you know, we're not judging some of the wonderful people who work for Cirque du Soleil or, you know, clowns as entertainers, and they may be,
well,
you know,
well, like
people.
I said, the Shriners, when they get on those little tiny tricycles and they go do their little clown routine. I mean, those are wonderful people. You know, I'm talking about just clowns in general. I mean, I remember going to a mall a couple of years ago, and some clown was making balloons for kids, and he kind of looked at me, and just imagine this for a second, Jonathan, a look in slow motion with this very evil grin and these beady red eyes from a distance. And I mean, those are scary things.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that there are some very scary people who put on masks. I think the other thing is the mask, because this is something that we face all the time. And is one of the things that your aunt, Dr. Carrigula, pointed out about the energy sappers, is that these would be people that would be, she put it, volubly altruistic. They would always be talking about how much they care about others and care about causes and care about their friends, just like John Wayne Gacy, you know, was dressing up as a clown to help children in the hospital. And he belonged to all those, you know, civic groups, and people thought he was a great guy. But underneath the masks that are presented to us, there may be predators and parasites, and we all kind of sense that. And so sometimes when we see these masked figures, I think Stanley Kubrick did a very powerful job with them in Eyes Wide Shut.
I love that movie.
Right, me too. I think that's an image of the parasites as well. There's a number of some of the most haunting movies out there that I think really have a theme about the parasites. A lot of the David Lynch films. The most recent Batman film is one of the very best, The Scarecrow. We have this very good-looking guy played by Cillian Murphy, but what does he do? He sprays you with neuropharmaceuticals that make you intensely afraid, so he appears haunting.
Jonathan, we're going to be back. We're going to have phone calls with you. Those of you who want to share some of your psychic vampire stories, or perhaps you just have a question or two, it'll be your turn next. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.